So as we walk through the wilderness, one of the things that we're commanded to do is count the Omer. As we walk through our journey, as we keep the feast, as we come out of Passover, as we go on toward Shavuot. But what does it mean? What's the spiritual significance? And what were the children of Israel doing during this time frame? What happened? What were the events that they were walking through? I've titled the message this morning, The Omer and Walking with Yahweh. And I'm using the term the Omer instead of the count for a reason. Because the word Omer has a significance in measure. Even though we can count, but what are we counting? The Omer has so much more meaning because it actually is a certain volume. It's about the volume that was necessary for a loaf of challah bread. And a loaf of challah bread is about the portion size that each individual would have needed to pick up of manna as they went through the wilderness, and that was their daily bread. So as we count the Omer, one of the things that it teaches us is, your word is more necessary to me than my daily bread. So that's one of the purposes that he tells us to count the Omer. Now, one of the first statements that I have written down here is one that I actually borrowed from someone. I do not know who wrote this book, but someone came up to me here a couple months ago and said, I'm reading a book right now, and the title of the book is Don't Waste Your Wilderness. Now, every one of us, when I say your wilderness, our minds go back to a time, or maybe they're in the current time frame, of a thing that we're walking through or that we have walked through that was an extremely difficult time in our lives. And when we go through the wilderness, the reason the title of the book is Don't Waste Your Wilderness is because it's in the wilderness that we don't have anything else that we can rely on other than the Father himself. And in that title, Don't Waste Your Wilderness, it hit me so hard because so many times all we want to do is get through it. So many times we don't take the time to sit there and say, Yahweh, you have provided for me when it seems like there's absolutely no way I'm going to make it through this. But in the wilderness, he reveals himself to us in a way that he cannot when all our needs are met. If everything that we need is given to us and we have no needs, are we grateful or do we forget? And see, he says, don't forget to thank me when you're full. But he doesn't say anything about when we're in the wilderness. You know why? Because it's not hard for me to remember to ask him for something that I need when I don't have it. But when I'm full, everything's going good. It's a lot less likely that I'll forget to spend time on my knees if I'm wondering if I'll have bread the next day. It's a lot less likely that I'll take for granted my spiritual walk if my very sustenance depends on it. And so in the wilderness, that's the first thing that he brought the people of Israel to after they were redeemed at Passover. And the reason is because even though he redeemed them at Passover, but he knew that they would forget very quickly where their redemption came from. And so the first thing that they needed to understand is, not only can I deliver you, but I can also sustain you. And so in the wilderness, Yahweh wants to teach us, I am all you need. And if you have me, There's nothing else that's necessary. Because I love you. Because I created you. Because I designed you. And therefore, I know what you need. Communion with me will bring you to that secret place, will bring you to that sustenance. How many times do we see in the scriptures when there was a man of Yahweh who went into his presence without food or water for 40 days and 40 nights? You can't do that in this body. Which brings me to another point about the Omer. In the time that they were in the wilderness, and in the time that we walk through our wilderness, we have the opportunity to be spiritually refined and come in touch with the supernatural. Or we have on the other side the opportunity to walk after the beast nature. And in 50 days, where will I be? Will I be bowing down to a golden calf? Or will I be in communion with the Creator of the universe? That's our choices. We're told to count for 7 weeks, 49 days. Time was given to man because if there would not be time, we would not have had an absolute for sin. Now, time was given before Adam sinned, but it would not have been necessary other than the fact that Yahweh knew Adam is going to sin, so therefore Adam is going to have to die. These bodies are subject to time. Our spiritual bodies are eternal. Yahweh is eternal. He lives outside the realm of time. It would have been just as easy for him to set up the garden in a timeless way. But he did not, because he knew that sin would have to be dealt with. So one of the things that we see in the counting of the Omer, when we count weeks, it represents days, weeks, months. But that 50th day falls outside the measured weeks that he tells us to count. So what does 50 represent? You have the Jubilee. You have the eternal realm. You have something that's outside of time. So counting the Omer, if we're faithful to do what we're supposed to do, it will actually put us in touch with a spiritual side that we can't get to outside of going through the 49 days that we're asked to go through. Deuteronomy 8:2 says, "And you shall remember that Yahweh your Elohim led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not." Now that tells me that until we go through trials, testings, the wilderness, we can't really recognize what's in our hearts. Because if Yahweh needs to test us to see what's in our hearts, we sure won't know until we go through the testings. 1 Peter 4:12 says, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you." Now I'm going to shift gears just a little bit and talk about some men that we all admire. We often want to be like these men. We often want to emulate them. We often want to strive to have their character. And the first one I have listed here is Job. Who wouldn't want to be a businessman with the success of Job? Who wouldn't want to have the most beautiful daughters in the land? Who wouldn't want to have no physical needs as far as finances, as far as being self-sustained? Pretty much every meal at Job's house probably came straight from his fields. But are you willing to lose everything before you reach the pinnacle that Job reached? Are you willing to walk through having boils and sores and having a wife that says, "What's wrong with you? Why don't you just curse God and die? Just be done with it." He was alone in his service of the Master. And even his best friends came to him and told him, "The reason this is happening to you is because you're a wicked man." And in the middle of that trial, the truth of the matter was, is Job did not ascribe to the Almighty the ability to be Almighty until after Yahweh comes down and questions Job himself. And after Yahweh questions Job himself, then Job says, "Behold, every man is wicked and Yahweh is righteous." But it took the wilderness for Job to see that. Even though Job was diligent to sacrifice, was diligent to do what was right, and even Yahweh himself says, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth?" So he stood head and shoulders above everybody else in spirituality and in character, and yet even Job had a character flaw, and whenever his personal life was touched, he said, "This shouldn't be happening to me." And he questioned God's Elohim's wisdom in his life. Abraham, are you willing to leave your family, leave your country, leave everything that's familiar to you? And then the only person that's related to you that comes with you winds up being a thorn in your side. How many times did Abraham have to deliver Lot? What about Abraham's grandnephews and nieces that lived with Lot in Sodom and Gomorrah that got lost to the sinful city? And what about the very daughters that came out with Lot who gave evidence in their years that the city had got into them? They got out of the city, but the city didn't get out of them. What about Joseph? You want to be like Joseph? Are you willing to be sold by your family as a slave? Are you willing to go into the prison on a false accusation? And are you willing to stay there for years, even after you have access to the highest office in the land for your freedom, but you're forgotten? Are you willing to go to prison if you know that in the end Yahweh will elevate you? Maybe. But Joseph didn't know. He had no way of knowing what the end would be. I wonder how many times he doubted his dreams whenever he was there in the prison. I wonder how many times he thought it was probably hormonal. How about Moses? You know, Moses, we just watched The Prince of Egypt at home during this time. Moses had the opportunity, very likely, to become the next Pharaoh of Egypt. And yet he chose to suffer with Yahweh's people. Do I have that kind of character? That I would bow my back to the lash for his purposes? Am I willing to go through a wilderness of that degree? How about David? We all want to be like David, man after God's own heart. But what did it take for David to get there? He ran for years from Saul, leading a band of lawbreakers, running for his life, and all he had ever demonstrated to Saul was his loyalty on the battlefield and was his proficiency as a player on an instrument. And yet, Saul sought his life. That's about as bad of a wilderness as it gets. And the only people that would follow him were those that were in trouble because of taxes, were malcontents, and worthless men. The scripture says, worthless men gathered themselves unto him. Am I willing to fellowship with the scum of the earth in my wilderness and still keep a good attitude and still keep following Yahweh? What kind of character does it take to make it through the wilderness that Yahweh has asked us to go through? Are we willing to recognize that He is our source, our sustainer, that He is our provider and defender, and that He is all we need? Daniel and his three friends. Am I willing to become a eunuch in the court of the king? Now, for the sake of keeping it G-rated, I'm not going to go into what that means. But you men understand. Daniel and his three friends, when they were taken into captivity, they were made eunuchs in order to serve in the court of the king. And then we have the ultimate example. And on this one, we don't get the option of whether we want to be made in His image or not. Because on this one, we're commanded to be made in His image. And Yeshua was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from Him. And Yahweh says that it is His will that we be conformed into the image of His Son. Am I willing to be conformed into the image of His Son? That's a tall order. And that's why it says that He giveth more grace. Wherefore He says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. In the wilderness, we can choose to be rebellious or to be refined. In the wilderness, we can choose to be rebellious or to be refined. It's our choice. We're going to have a wilderness experience sooner or later. And it's our choice whether or not we allow it to change us for the better or for the worse. And I submit to you that the Omer is one of the things annually that we walk through that has a wilderness journey in it. Some years stronger than others. But it's there for a purpose. Because what He took His people through in the past, He will take His people through in the present and also again in the future. These things are given for our examples that we would know what to expect. When we walk these feast cycles out, we can put ourselves in the journey of the Israelites and know that whatever it was that happened to them at that time, it's coming in our lives. But we can study their journey and be prepared for what's about to happen to us. And that's what gives us hope that if they were able to make it through the counting of the Omer and get to the mountain, and some of them were victorious, not everybody bowed down to the golden calf. Some people worshiped Yahweh. Some people made a commitment to be on Yahweh's side. We are only one choice away from spirituality or sensuality. We are only one choice away from spirituality or sensuality. There's some things that we're commanded to do also, and this is interesting because it says to crucify the flesh with its passions and desires. That means at that point the flesh is alive. But we're commanded to crucify it. The flesh will scream, holler, try to keep us from putting it on that cross. That's one of the things that's symbolized by the first stop in the wilderness, the bitter waters of Marah. And what did they do? They put a tree in the water. And it's a picture of crucifixion. They murmured against Yahweh there. They needed to crucify the flesh. And that picture of the tree is a picture of crucifixion, and that's what made that bitter water sweet. It says to die to self. So at that point, the flesh has learned what crucifixion means. And then he says to walk in the Spirit. Crucify the flesh, die to self, and walk in the Spirit. Now, sometimes sources that we use are unexpected in the information that they divulge. And one of those things happened to me yesterday afternoon. And I thought, just out of the blue, I wonder what Wikipedia has to say about counting the Omer. And I was blown away what this seemingly strictly informational, supposedly, source had to say about this. This comes word for word from Wikipedia, and I didn't keep everything in it because there was a lot. But it says, this step-by-step journey through the wilderness was a time of trial and testing and teaching the Israelites to trust and obedience as he dealt with their fleshly nature in preparation for their time of encounter with him at Sinai. And then I omitted a pretty big part. And it goes on to say, if we would submit, so this man is writing as if we don't, but he's writing this to the general public. And he says, if we would submit to Yahweh's timetable and pattern by literally counting the Omer, we would be in harmony with the moving of his Spirit in our lives in overcoming the flesh. As we go through the process of marking off each day and go through the ritual celebration, we are inscribing the significance of the Omer upon us and ordaining the day for the sanctifying work of the Spirit in our lives. I was blown away by Wikipedia. And what's interesting about that statement is, when do we count? At sundown in the beginning of the next day. So when he says we are ordaining the day for the sanctifying work of the Spirit in our lives, how much more fitting can it be that we would count the evening before so that through the night and the next day it is ordained that his Spirit purify us, sanctify us, and bring us, spirit, soul, and body, to the foot of the mountain to receive his word, to receive his Spirit. Human nature is the most desperate in the wilderness because that is where it is most likely to be crucified. Human nature is the most desperate in the wilderness because that is where it is most likely to be crucified. And why is that? They hungered. They thirsted. They had literal, legitimate needs that they felt were not going to be met. And if you look, a lot of times our appetites are what get us into trouble. That does not mean that our appetites are not legitimate. But our appetites must be governed. And if you look at the Torah, it says, taste not, touch not, do not make incense to smell. Yeshua talks about looking on a woman to lust after her. It says, you shall not hear an oath. The Torah was given to sinful man after they were redeemed to teach us how to govern this physical body. Because Yahweh knows that if we can govern our appetites, he's not going to have trouble having a relationship with our heart. If we can govern our physical appetites, Yahweh will have a relationship, a spiritual relationship with his people. Exodus 32 talks about, now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt." Who brought the children of Israel out of Egypt? Yahweh brought them out. Why were the people looking to a man? Because they didn't understand who was really leading them. And I would submit to you that some of them had not been willing to crucify the flesh and were, at this point, they had grumbled, they had complained, they had hungered, they had thirsted. And I would submit to you that they had not dealt with these emotions in a righteous way. They had not crucified the flesh. And so at this point, when Moses goes up to the mountain, they were not prepared to worship Yahweh. They were still, their gods were still their belly. They were still looking for a lack of restraint. They still wanted to do what they wanted to do, when they wanted to do it, and how they wanted to do it. So Aaron said to them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in your ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters and bring them to me." Now, what's the matter with Aaron? I thought he's supposed to be helping out here. He's supposed to be in charge while Moses was gone. But if you remember, there was a time when Moses was in the wilderness, when Moses operated in fear. And what did Yahweh do? He said, "Fine. I'll take your brother with you then, because I know he can speak. But as for you, who made man's mouth?" Moses should have overcome his flesh and walked in the Spirit. So this problem that happens here at the mountain is partly Moses' fault. So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And Aaron took a tool and made a molded calf. And they said, the people said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." So now it goes from being Moses, who's not in sight anymore, to being something that they just made. And they're sitting here worshiping, saying, "This thing brought us out of Egypt," after they just made it. Now, how can this thing bring you out whenever you just saw it come out of the fire? When we're in the wilderness, one of the things that you see when you're thirsty and you're hungry and you're in the wilderness and you're starving and you're about to thirst to death is a mirage. When we get in our wilderness, take care that you don't see a mirage for reality. Take care when you're in your wilderness that you don't see a mirage as though it was your reality. That's what they saw. So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to Yahweh." And they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. So at this point, they're walking after their physical appetites and they are unrestrained. And Yahweh said to Moses, "I have seen this people." I'm sorry, let me back up. Exodus 32, verse 7. And Yahweh said to Moses, "Go, get down, for your people whom you brought out, your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.'" And Yahweh said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore, leave me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, and I will make of you a great nation." Then Moses pleaded with Yahweh, his Elohim, and said, Yahweh, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak and say, he brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains, and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce wrath and relent from this harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of, I give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. In verse 14, so Yahweh relented from the harm which he said he would do to his people. And Moses turned and went down from the mountain, and the two tablets of the testimony were in his hand. The tablets were written on both sides. On one side and on the other they were written. Now the tablets were the work of Yahweh, and the writing was the writing of Elohim engraved on the tablets. And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, there is a noise of war in the camp. But he said, it is not the noise of the shout of victory, nor the noise of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing I hear. So it was, as soon as he came near the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing. So Moses' anger became hot. Now he just got done telling Yahweh, just, you know, it's okay, just calm down, you know, don't wipe them off the face of the earth. But when Moses sees what Yahweh saw, then his anger becomes hot. And he cast the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. And he gets to Aaron and he says, what did this people do to you that you have brought so great a sin on them? I think Moses knew his brother. When he saw that, he realized that there's a leadership problem here. And Aaron said, well, don't let your anger become hot. Well, the scripture says his anger was already hot. So how much further, what more degree could it have gotten to? He says, you know the people, they are set on evil. But I wonder if Moses knew that Aaron was kind of inclined that way himself. And the scripture talks about a man's children and grandchildren being evidence of the man. And what happened to some of Aaron's sons? They were killed by Yahweh because of profane fire. So that tells me that this is not the first issue that Aaron has had with serving Yahweh. And I would submit to you that probably in Aaron's wilderness, he was not faithful to his Elohim. And as his sons saw that bear out in his life, was the reason why they gave in to their flesh at times. Now, when Moses saw that the people were unrestrained, for Aaron had not restrained them to their shame among their enemies, then Moses stood in the entrance of the camp and said, whoever is on Yahweh's side, come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together to him. And he said to them, thus says Yahweh Elohim of Israel, let every man put his sword on his side and go in and out from entrance to entrance throughout the camp. And let every man kill his brother, his companion, and his neighbor. And so the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses. Now here's a situation in the wilderness where the wilderness just got a lot tougher. Here's men that rose up against family members, acquaintances, neighbors, people that they had been through slavery with, people that they had come out of Egypt with, people that they sat around a campfire with and probably roasted lamb with. Maybe some of them had eaten the Passover together with each other. This was a big deal. And that's why the sons of Levi were set apart as a priesthood to Yahweh after this point. Then Moses says, consecrate yourselves today to Yahweh that he may bestow on you a blessing this day. For every man has opposed his son and his brother. Now it came to pass on the next day that Moses said to the people, "You have committed a great sin. So now I will go up to Yahweh. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." Then Moses returned to Yahweh and said, "Oh, these people have committed a great sin, have made for themselves a god of gold. Yet now, if you will forgive their sin, but if not, I pray, blot me out of their book which you have written." What kind of a man was Moses? Moses was the kind of man that understood he was a murderer and he was forgiven. And Moses understood that if anybody deserved Yahweh's wrath, it was him. And each one of us needs to understand that if anybody deserves Yahweh's wrath, it's me. And that knowledge and that understanding and that realization will change our perspective toward the people that we see that we are walking through the wilderness with. That knowledge will give us compassion. That knowledge will help us to lift someone up. That understanding will give us mercy to our brothers who may have offended us. That knowledge will help us to bond together and realize Yahweh is Elohim and we are insignificant. And that knowledge will give us a strength and a purpose and a courage and a will to do His will that nothing else can. It's the redemption story. It's forgiveness. It's spiritual empowerment. And walking through the days of the Omer is the time frame that these things happened to the children of Israel. "Now therefore," Yahweh says to Moses in verse 34, "go, lead the people to the place of which I have spoken to you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit for punishment, I will visit punishment upon them for their sin." So Yahweh plagued the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron made. And one of the laws of sowing and reaping applies here. And that law is this: you reap in a different season than you sow. So in the wilderness, we have a choice. We can move towards spiritual empowerment or natural depravity. And we have this in the tribe of Levi and the people of Israel. We have this in Moses and in Aaron. And we have this contrast multiple times as we go through this story. Now, there's something interesting here that I never saw until this year. What was the original purpose of the tabernacle, the first tabernacle in the wilderness? What was it used for before it was used for a tabernacle? Does anyone know? It was Moses' personal tent. The scripture says in Exodus 33:7-23, it says, "Moses took his tent." Now, if we would have read before we got to here, Moses is on the mountain. Yahweh gives him the instructions on how to build the tabernacle. But at this point, they don't have a tabernacle to build according to the pattern. And so, rather than not have anything, Moses, of his personal self, while he's walking through this situation, is so focused on Yahweh and Yahweh's people that he puts his own needs for lodging second to the needs of the people and the needs of Yahweh to have a meeting place. And he takes his tent and he says, he pitched it outside the camp, far from the camp, and called it the Tabernacle of Meeting. And it came to pass that everyone who sought Yahweh went out to the tabernacle of meeting, which was outside the camp. And see, in this simple act of pitching this tent far outside the camp, it did several things. One of the things that it did was it separated the sheep from the goats. One of the things that it did was it showed Moses who cared what Yahweh had to say. Because it says, whoever wished to seek Yahweh went out to the tabernacle of meeting. What about the rest of them? So even here, we see a separation between spirituality and carnality. And there's something else interesting here. It says that Yahweh, when Moses entered the tabernacle, this is Moses' house, that the pillar of cloud descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and Yahweh spoke with Moses. And all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the tabernacle door. And all the people rose and worshiped, each man in his tent door. So Yahweh spoke to Moses face to face in Moses' house, as a man speaks to his friend. And he would return to the camp, but his servant, Joshua the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle. What kind of dedication did Joshua have that he was willing to leave his own tent and spend time fellowship with Yahweh? And when we go back through the scriptures and we see all the times that Joshua is mentioned and that he has a different spirit, is this why? More than likely, when you spend time in his presence, he will give you a different spirit. When you spend time in his presence in the wilderness, he will sure enough give you a different spirit. You will view the things that you're going through differently when you spend time with him in the wilderness. Look at Job. Look at David. Look at Daniel and his three friends. These men, when the going got tough, they spent time in the presence of the Father. And that is what gave them the character that we so admire. So then Moses says, "See, you say to me, 'Bring up this people,' but you have not let me know whom you will send with me." Now I think Moses was noticing this young man and saying, "I hope you're planning on appointing him, because I kind of need him." But look at what Yahweh says. Moses says, "Yet you have said, 'I know you by name, and you have also found grace in my sight.' Now therefore I pray, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way, that I may know you and that I may find grace in your sight. And consider that this nation is your people." And Yahweh said to him, "Not Joshua the son of Nun will go up with you." But he said, "My presence will go up with you." And I think Moses had an epiphany right then. Because he says, if your presence does not go with us, do not bring us up from here. And I think all of a sudden Moses realized that there is actually a potential for Yahweh's presence not to go up with a rebellious people. And I think Moses feared Yahweh at that point. And I think it gave a whole new purpose and a whole new passion toward making sure that Yahweh had a house in that congregation. Because it doesn't take long, if you continue to read, where he starts asking for the goods to make the tabernacle. And I think he realized how important it was to have Yahweh's presence in a whole nother way. I think he knew it before, but I think he really knew it then. And the same way in us, in our lives, when we go through this counting of the Omer, when we see wilderness in our lives, and we see Yahweh deliver us, how much does that do to us to cement the fact in our minds that we have to have his presence with us, or we're not going to make it through the wilderness? That's where he wants us to be when we come into our wilderness. He wants us utterly and totally dependent on him to send his presence into our homes and into our lives so that he can bring us through and bring us out. So after this, when Yahweh sees Moses' passion to have his presence among them, Yahweh shows Moses his goodness, but he doesn't show him his face because he says, no man will see my face and live. So the question I have is, where will I be in 50 days? Will I be at the base of the golden, at the base of the golden calf? Or will I be in the presence of Yahweh? Because that's our choice. So he says in Deuteronomy 16:9, you shall count 7 weeks for yourself. Begin to count the 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the grain. Then you shall keep the feast of weeks to Yahweh your Elohim with the tribute of a freewill offering from your hand, which you shall give as Yahweh your Elohim blesses you. You shall rejoice before Yahweh your Elohim, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant and your female servant, and the Levite who is within your gates, the stranger and the fatherless, and the widow who are among you, at the place where Yahweh chooses to make his name abide. And you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and you shall be careful to observe these statutes. The choices that we make during these 7 weeks, the Omer teaches us these choices that we make in physical time, that we're counting with the weeks, will determine our destiny in the eternal. The choices that we make while we're counting 49 days will determine our destiny in that 50th day. Will I remember to count, or will I forget? Is it important, or is it not important? Let's live intentionally. Let's not live randomly. He gives us clear, simple instructions. How many people in here can count to 50? If we can count to 50, let's do it. 7 weeks plus a day teaches us that completing the count takes us outside the natural realm of time as we know it and puts us in touch with the supernatural. And that's why the physical act of counting connects us with the refining of our spirit. Thank you. The glory of the Lord.